Welcome to Red Alert Radio, grassroots radio with an ear on the issues that matter to you.
Tēnā koto katoa, ko Greg Preslin taku ingoa. I'm Greg Preslin and this is Red Radio. And I have a very special guest with me today, my old mate David Cunliffe, former leader of the Labor Party, MP for Newland from 1999 to 2017. And how are you going, David?
Very well, thank you, Greg. Absolutely wonderful to be here with you, our new soon-to-be councillor for the Faux Ward. Everybody get out and vote for Greg if you haven't already. You'd be deaf, dumb and blind not to have this man helping to run Auckland Council.
Thank you very much, David.
Let's get that over with and keep repeating it through the broadcast because it's important. That paper sitting on your shelf at home, sign it, post it, or drop it in now.
Yeah, thank you very much. So it's been 2 years since you've been out of Parliament. How are you feeling now?
I'm feeling great. Thank you very much. It's a new chapter and a new lease on life. I got to Parliament in the first place because I wanted to make the world a better place. And it's a pretty messy way to do it sometimes. But they say making laws is like making sausages. They taste good, but you don't want to watch them being made. That is true. So I'm management consulting, something that I did before I was in politics. I'm a partner in a strategy consulting firm downtown in Auckland. We work nationwide with companies and public sector organisations to help them solve hard problems or unfamiliar problems like digital disruption in an industry, like a region trying to come together around a regional development plan, like restructuring a business that's going through a merger or something like that. So there are all sorts of issues. I kind of joke about it and say we're trying to make the world a bit more functional, one organisation at a time.
And no regrets that you are no longer in Parliament?
Oh, you always get a little whiff of gunpowder in the nostrils. But I really was very honoured to have the opportunity to serve for nearly 20 years. That's a good innings, as they say, and it's great to have a bit more time for my teenage kids and to just try some new horizons. So you can sort of wrestle down a little bit deeper working with organisations than you can working across the whole canvas. So it's very satisfying. Haven't changed my political views and I'm still a member of the Labor Party and still help out occasionally where I can.
And I guess you get the benefit of standing outside and looking in and seeing the process working now.
Yeah, and it's an interesting perspective. It is a bit different. I mean, you do, with the benefit of experience and hindsight, realise that there are, you know, good and not so good people on all sides of politics, that no one party has a monopoly on truth. But having said that, you know, I have a clear view about some of the challenges that we face as a country and as a world. And that seems to align pretty strongly with the policies of one side of politics. So that's why I maintain a view that it is very compatible with that of the Labor Party.
And that's a very good way to segue into my next question. The world is facing a climate crisis, and it's probably the current biggest challenge that we have. And this week in the United Nations Climate Change Summit, we've had a young 16-year-old Swedish girl Greta Thunberg talk about fairy tales of eternal economic growth. And that reminded me of the speech that you gave 7 years ago, The Dolphins and the Dolcues, where you tried to work out the tension there is between economic growth and providing jobs and looking after our environment.
And we talked to thanks, Greg. Yeah, it was a while ago, and you've just given me a copy of the speech to read over. It wasn't too bad of an effort, but it was a heck of a long speech. I feel sorry for people who listen to it delivered live. One of the key themes was that there's a bunch of easy myths that people have been relying upon which might run out. One of those is the myth of endless cheap energy. Another one is the myth of green growth, which is that you can just put green paint over an economic engine that isn't fundamentally changed and everything will be all right. Well, it won't. And if we had any doubt about the reality of global climate change 7 years ago, and I must say you and I did not, but some people did, there is absolutely no, repeat no, scientific basis for doubting the contention that the planet's climate is warming disastrously quickly that is at least correlated and extremely probably caused by human-induced emissions of greenhouse gases like methane, carbon dioxide and nitrous oxide. That process is reversible, but it takes about 50 years to turn the boat around. And in that time lag, we could experience enough warming where self-reinforcing multipliers kick in. Example, the climate warms to the level where the subarctic tundra starts to thaw and releases a whole lot of methane that has been locked up for millennia in peat bogs across Siberia. That methane then adds to global warming and creates more warming, which thaws more tundra, and so on. Or another one, that the Arctic ice melt, which is about 45% greater than it was 100 years ago. And there's, in some seasons, almost no ice left over the North Pole. It's amazing. It's shocking. And they're talking about opening the Arctic for sea lanes, would you believe, for part of the year, that could fundamentally disrupt some of the sea current patterns, changing climates for places like Scandinavia. And, of course, we get more cyclones, more Category 4 and 5 cyclones. Is anybody surprised? We get what we pay for. And if we want to ignore the planet and ignore reality and lose ourselves in cheap, silly political slogans by snake oil merchants who are trying to make hard-pressed middle-income earners feel better and ignore the problem, if that's what we vote for, we will get a hard landing. We don't have to, but there is a really strong chance that's what's going to happen.
And isn't that part of the problem, that 7 years ago we were talking about these being possibilities, and now we are seeing the tundra with fires, Alaska burning, Greenland melting, exactly as was predicted.
Australia burning in September, not January. Greenland melting at about three times what was seen as the likely maximum rate. And what this adds up to for listeners, and it is a complex area, but bear in mind the two numbers. One is 1.5 degrees of warming, which is generally seen by the scientific community as a maximum sort of safe, adjustable level, and 2 degrees warming, which is a kind of fallback position. If you can't turn the boat around in 1.5, then two's a must do, and that's what nations except a couple, like America, signed up to at the Paris Accord as a backstop. Now, the problem is if you go over 2 degrees, you start getting a very much increased probability of those self-reinforcing effects. And some scientists would say at 2.5 degrees, it's about 50-50. That's truly frightening because it means that to turn that boat around, we would have to have much, much more dramatic cuts to greenhouse emissions, much more fundamental economic dislocation. You know, people thought the Wall Street crash was bad. We could be in for something much, much more shocking in the next generation. So Greta Thunberg, sadly, has every right to feel her childhood has been stolen because the land of climate innocence is gone. And we are all going to have to get our heads for our children's sake. We all love our kids. My God, we're leaving them a world that is much, much harder to navigate than the one we inherited at the end of the post-war generation. And our generation, frankly, should be ashamed of ourselves. We have been collectively too slow to see the writing on the wall, and because we have not taken the courageous steps that we needed to take in time, we are bequeathing a much harder, indeed potentially species-threatening, and I don't mean bugs and critters, I mean our species-threatening issue for our great-grandchildren.
Mm. So that 7 years of drift for New Zealand Inc. 2012, we had a national government who, they were prepared to talk about it, but they were never prepared to make any of the hard decisions, were they? We had an emissions trading scheme which was in place.
Which was watered down. Agriculture was left out. There was big subsidies, very slow on-ramp. Look, the New Zealand conservative side of politics isn't as bad as many. And we are lucky that in New Zealand we have a healthy, functioning democracy where people can still talk to each other meaningfully across party lines. And I want to acknowledge that the then government, now in opposition, is working constructively with the Labor-led coalition on climate legislation, which would, if passed, create an independent climate commission who would have the legal authority to regulate to achieve carbon reduction targets set by Parliament. That is the model that the UK is embracing. I think it's an excellent model. It was recommended by the Parliamentary Commissioner for the Environment, Jan Wright, who is likely to be sitting on the commission. Excellent person. So I think that that is progress, and I don't want to demonise any particular party. This is me and my post-parliamentary clothes. But what I would say is that New Zealand as a whole, while it's done better than some countries, let's just all sit and admit together that our carbon emissions have grown still over the last 20 years, and we're only just starting to slow them down and turn them around now. And the longer we wait, the harder the pain. So we may as well get started.
So the targets of the zero carbon bill, carbon neutral by 2050, that's much stronger than the previous government position, and it's what you have to do, isn't it, if you are going to stop global warming.
It's a very challenging target. If the world did it, we'd have a good chance of turning this boat around. And New Zealand is in many ways now seen as a beacon, as a beacon of hope in a world that is riven by some very, very serious cultural, political and strategic divisions, and by having a forward-looking, humane and far-sighted set of policies, I think we can make our best contribution to the planet.
And how do you think that will look in practice? For instance, energy, electricity generation, we're about 80% renewable right now. Yep. So to get to just about 100% is not difficult.
No, I mean, we're very blessed, actually. We have not only a lot of rain, which gives us the opportunity to have more than 70% of our power generated by hydro, but we have geothermal, and it's very windy.
So take your pick.
Or some combination. Now, that's not to say, and it's a note of kind of realism here, it's not to say that we can probably completely do without a little bit of thermal capacity to cover the absolute peaks. And because that would only be used occasionally, it's not an economic proposition for anybody to own it. So that's going to have to be something that's sort of socially insured or subsidised. And the less that we use it, the better that will be for the climate. But it's as I'm advised, it's not currently yet quite possible to store enough electricity in massive batteries from solar and wind to cover the surges efficiently during the peak. You'd have to have a lot more spare capacity slopping around to do that, so it's efficient still to have a little bit of thermal peaking, but we're talking a couple of percent of total.
Yep.
So we can get above 95, I think, without too much trouble.
Yep. Transport might be the most difficult one.
Yep.
It's been suggested to me if transport's going to be carbon neutral by 2050, then by 2030... we're going to have to stop introducing petrol-driven, petrol-powered cars into the fleet.
I've bought my last combustion engine. No, that's true, I have. I've got a hybrid at the moment, but I'm looking to sell it. And I will either be buying an EV or nothing. And it's actually one of the really hopeful stories is that transport's changing so fast. And it'll only be probably 3 to 5 years before EVs are the majority of units sold. And it may only be another 5 years after that most people don't own cars. In fact, owning a whole lot of second-hand cars at the moment would be quite a risky job. Yeah. Because people will get into ride-sharing services. I mean, if you're downtown now as I am, you know, I use a scooter or I use an Uber or an Ola, and it's more of a pain than it's worth trying to find a car park. So why wouldn't I? Now, it's also cheaper, by the way. I worked it out. But it cost me about half as much to use ride-sharing services than it does to own, insure, depreciate, maintain a vehicle. And so why wouldn't I do the smart and environmentally friendly thing? But that requires a change elsewhere. It's easy enough if I'm living in a little flat downtown to make that transition. It's a lot harder if I'm having to commute from Drury or somewhere. And there is a huge interface between the future of transport and the future of urban design. If we want to have ribbon cities, then we're going to have either really good public transport infrastructure to service that, or maintain an emissions profile that we don't want. So it's all around intensification. This is something that I know, Greg, you've been working on a lot and be part of your future role on Auckland Council, no doubt, is designing modern cities around public transport. And you can see it in Glen Eden. You can see it in New Lynn. New Lynn, by the way, remember when we worked on that transport-oriented development and Treasury said it wasn't worth doing and we convinced the Minister of Finance that it was? And, folks, it is now, I think, the second or third most patronised transport hub in New Zealand after Britomart, bigger than Wellington, bigger than Christchurch. Yeah. 70% of properties within a kilometre radius have changed hands and billions of dollars of investment have flowed into New Lynn. So nobody need make the argument that good public transport doesn't pay. It pays bucket loads and it ends up with smarter, more sustainable cities. So let's do it.
Yep, every time I catch the train through New Lynn, I think just as well it was trenched because if it hadn't have been trenched, it would have wrecked the town.
It would have, and it would have been a safety issue, a disaster. So I fully want to acknowledge Sir Bob Harvey and Sir Michael Cullen, who were crucial to getting that change done, and it's a good thing that your Labor representatives in West Auckland achieved in days gone by.
Yeah, actually, one of the things that I'm proud about our collective effort is the rail through the northwest. It's an outstanding service.
It is. It's fantastic. Double tracked, electrified,
regular 10 minutes.
Yeah,
going down to 6 as soon as the city running.
Look, as soon as city CRL is done, that's just going to be a fabulous service. And I think what you'll see is that people are more and more comfortable and desiring to live closer to those railway stops and transport nodes, and that'll put property prices up close to the rail line, and those signals will be really, really clear, pardon the pun.
Yeah. But that brings us to another point, and that is that that was 10, 15 years' worth of planning and building, mm-hmm. and we need to be doing 4 or 5 of those through the region.
Yeah.
Northwestern Motorway, for instance, there's just no provision there right now for high-quality public transport. And that's
I guess it's a little bit of one thing at a time. I do want to give credit to Mayor Phil Gough and to the current government for biting the bullet and investing in the City Rail Loop, for pushing the envelope on light rail on the Isthmus, and for considering, and, you know, Mr. Twyford needs some credit for this. He's had a bit of a knock in some other areas, but really working hard on what a more sustainable transport system would be like in Auckland. And it's crucial because if we don't turn Auckland into a modern functioning global city, then the country will not be able to participate as well in global, as I say, value chains. And it's really important for us to get that right. And you can't run a city without modern transport. And Dove Meyer Robinson was right when he said in the 70s, get into it, and we didn't. So now we're playing catch-up. So let's give credit where it's due. Obviously, we need that regional fuel tax. Current opposition's barking up the wrong tree if they think that can be done away with. We may have to face congestion pricing at some point. If we do, we're going to have to think really carefully about how that impacts those in lower socioeconomic groups. And it may need to be offset by some form of income adjustment for them. That's a hard issue. And, of course, there are areas in the city that are not well served. We do have the Northern Busway. It would be lovely to have some form of rail link on the North Shore. It'll probably be necessary to extend at least that busway further up. And park and ride's really important, because try finding a car park at Albany in the morning, you know. There's so much housing development up that way. And look, whenever we do development, we need to think about public transport. Simple as that.
Yep.
Shouldn't be an argument.
Yep. Okay, some other aspects of your speech that you talked about. One was water quality. Back in 2012, it was a crisis, and it's even worse now, isn't it?
Yeah, it breaks your heart, really, doesn't it? I mean, not that I want to sound like an old man, but, you know, in our childhood, we would take swimming in our local river as a birthright. It wouldn't even be a question.
Yeah.
And it was free, and families and kids could just enjoy it. And now, something like, you have to correct me if I'm wrong, but I think only about 40% of our rivers are swimmable. What is that? That's not New Zealand.
Yeah. When I was a five-year-old kid growing up at Mangere Bridge, we used to swim in the Manukau and get pippies from there too.
Yeah, get pippies.
And it's something that you just wouldn't think about doing.
You wouldn't get the pippies at Mangere Bridge. No, you wouldn't. I shouldn't laugh because, look, this is fixable. I mean, we have a low population density. We know what causes this. It's not entirely, but it's quite largely agricultural runoff. Yeah. We know what it takes to reduce that. Buffer belts along waterways, reducing the intensity of some of our farming practices using more modern methods. It's not, to be fair, rocket science, and needs central government leadership, and it needs industry participation. But I believe it's doable, and full credit to the current government, both Minister Parker and some of our green colleagues who worked really hard on this water quality issue. Let's turn it around, Kiwis. Let's give our kids something good.
Now, something else you talked about in your speech, and it's one of those slightly taboo subjects.
Uh-oh.
And that was lifestyle, how we have to persuade ourselves as a race to live more simply and consume less.
Yeah, interesting, isn't it? Because it's also a well-being argument. Living more simply frees up headspace. And when you look at TV and you see all the noisy ads for plastic this or disposable that or cheap thrill something else, it's not really going to make you happy. So living more simply is wise at lots of levels. What I also touched on in the speech alongside that was the hope that technology would be our friend, and I still believe that largely it is, and that being an innovative society is a good idea, and that requires good conditions for business to invest in working capital and innovation. I think that's something the government's been pressing on, which is a good thing. For example, in the transport area, the rise of electric vehicles, the rise of autonomous vehicles, one day autonomous electric flying vehicles, which are currently being tested in New Zealand, will be, little plug there, will be flying around our cities. And the carbon impact of all of those things will be a lot lower than our transport technologies other than public transport currently being used. So that's one little example. The move to more permaculture and organic farming practices. I mean, there's a happy win-win there. I mean, educated consumers in rich countries around the world are prepared to pay massive premiums to get wholesome, organic food. And we are the world's number one high-quality food producer. Why wouldn't we embrace that premium? And in so doing, we can make our environment more sustainable and make this a better place to live. I tell you, the way the world is going, clever people from around the planet look to New Zealand as a haven, sometimes as a bastion, where they may live better in a world that is going crazy. So let's make the best of what we have, and a pristine environment's part of that recipe.
So our dairy industry, it's facing the prospect of having to halve methane output within 20, 30 years. So you think that's part of the solution for them?
Yeah, and it doesn't have to be a bad news story. And look, disclosure here, my company has done some work in the dairy industry. I can't say for whom and I can't say what. But I can, with some assurance, tell you that the client we've been working with is embracing sustainability big time, has ruthlessly gone through its carbon footprint. It's turning off some coal-fired production, and it is investing in cogen and solar and other environmentally friendly technologies. It's lightening the chemical footprint on its farms. It's using that to brand its particular type of milk as a high-quality milk, and it's having higher standards of animal welfare. And it's going to make money doing all those things. So what's not to like?
I'm always pleased to hear about those examples where corporate responsibility means that they're making the taking the hard decisions.
Yeah, my point is, and I agree with you, Greg, but my point is they're not doing it just because they believe it's the right thing to do. They believe it because, A, they feel that's right, but also because they think it will confer a market advantage, which will be realised through a price premium. Mm. And I believe they're right.
Yeah. So it's not so much an issue in New Zealand, but in Australia and America, it's arguable that the Corporates there are way ahead of the curve compared to their political leadership in terms of dealing with climate change. Do you think that's...
Yeah, I've had a bit of contact with Silicon Valley recently, and I think as a generalisation, there is a huge gulf between leading-edge thinking coming out of San Francisco and the current you know, dominant ideology in Washington. They are night and day different, and the threshold of what technologies can offer us for a more sustainable future is mind-blowing. And, you know, that's one of the things that makes me more hopeful. However, you know, there are threats too. It'll be great for the planet in some ways if there is, you know, careful how I say this, you know, proteins which aren't manufactured through cows. But that won't necessarily be good for New Zealand because we earn a lot from cows. So we're going to have to get ahead of that curve before it catches us out. There will always be a premium for high-quality natural food, and that's what we do better than anybody else in the world. But, you know, I think we either go up market, up quality, and that involves a lighter environmental footprint and more traceability, or we have, you know, low-cost production that has to look at some new technologies. Being stuck in the middle is probably not a good place. Just ask Fonterra.
Yep. And there is still that tension between corporate desire for growth and the, perhaps the necessity for the planet to stop thinking about growth.
Yeah, let me stick my neck out on something, again, dairy industry related. The idea that anybody can start a farm and start milking cows and a company has to take their production is barking mad. Because what it requires is they just have to dry it, turn it into cheap milk powder and sell it as a commodity.
Yeah.
That is not well aligned to the strategy that we've got a lighter footprint and higher value. We've only got a short time, I know. Back to you.
One last thing that we haven't talked about, trees. They're a big part of the solution, aren't they? We just need to start planting trees and keep planting trees and protect the ancient trees that we have.
Yep. And you've been an absolute courageous leader in that drive around Auckland and power to your arm, and I hope you have the opportunity, Greg, I sincerely do, to continue that leadership as a councillor in Auckland Council. So once again, folks, Greg is one of the most honest, most decent, most humane and hardest working political leaders that I have ever had the pleasure to get to know and to work with. I would literally trust him with my life and have done. And I would say that for anybody who is in West Auckland, you would be well advised to give supporting Greg and his colleagues your earnest consideration.
Well, thank you, David. Just as well we're on on radio, I'm blushing away. But
no, I mean it. I wouldn't say if I didn't mean it. And, you know, there are good and bad people on all sides of politics, but you're one of the best, my friend.
Thank you, David. So what next for you?
Well, look, I'm enjoying being a dad. You know, I've got a slightly enlarged family, and
it's a modern family.
A modern family, and I'm enjoying supporting four teenagers through those critical years. My oldest boy's just about to graduate high school and is most probably off to Africa next year to do frontline volunteer work, which is an amazing thing to see a young man do. And we've got three more to kind of get through those crucial exam years. And so between extracurricular music and sports and homework, people say, what do you do in your spare time after your day job? And I go, yeah, I'm a dad. So that's the simplest thing. And for someone who's spent so many days and nights running around in politics, it's a real privilege to have that opportunity. So I'm really enjoying that, Greg.
Well, thank you very much, David. I'd like to bring you back on the show some other stage because half an hour is far too short to get into these issues properly.
Whisked by, didn't it?
Thank you again.
Yeah, thanks, Greg.
Together next week at 9:05 a.m. or listen online anytime on planetaudio.org.nz/redalertradio.